May the light of God shine in our hearts and lead us to the Christ child. In the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer. On our pilgrimage to the Holy Land last summer, we visited the Herodium, the lavish palace of Herod the Great. It's in ruins, but it's still there. And it's complete with amphitheater and baths located just outside of Jerusalem. Herod was an ambitious and ruthless ruler who set himself up by balancing the delicate relations with the Roman Empire. He was paranoid, jealous, and fearful, and had one of his wives and three of his sons killed. This is the king to whom the Magi came. The writer of Matthew's Gospel says that Herod was frightened when the Magi came to him. In his commentary on this Gospel, theologian N.T. Wright says, "What Matthew tells us is political dynamite, that Jesus is the true king of the Jews, and old Herod is the false one, a usurper, an imposter. The house of Herod did not take kindly to the idea that anyone else could be claimed to be king of the Jews." Today is the last scene of the Christmas season. Unlike Luke's lore about no room at the inn and angels singing to shepherds, we come to the Gospel of Matthew, from which we will be reading most of this coming year. And Matthew wanted to interpret Jesus for his Jewish brothers and sisters, so he made lots of insider references to their religious heritage and to Old Testament prophecies fulfilled, etc. This account of the pagan seers seeking the newborn Jesus fits right into Matthew's plan to open to his parochial-minded audience the fact that the gospel is for all people. The gospel is universal. From the time of Jesus, the gospel belongs to all the nations, all races and religions, not just the chosen people. So where were these Magi, and why did Matthew tell us about them? They were religious seekers, perhaps a whole caravan of them. They were not Jews, and they did not know the Hebrew scriptures. They were philosophers, counselors of rulers, learned in all the wisdom of the East. They relied on their traditional way of knowing God through nature and reading of the stars at the times of their movements. So they were astrologers too. And P.S., nothing says that they were all male. In fact, some scholars insist that the text clearly indicates that some of these Magi were women because they asked for directions. The Magi start asking around town where to find the child who's been born king of the Jews. They get instructions to go to Bethlehem. They follow the star there and find the child with Mary, his mother. They kneel before him and open their treasure chests, presenting gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. Those gifts say something about who this child will be. Gold, a gift for a king. Frankincense, a gift for a priest. Myrrh, an embalming spice, which foreshadows what is to come for this child. The biblical scholar Raymond Brown notes that the church has really worked overtime in imagining this whole wise man story and this whole wise man strand, and understand this. The wise men are magi, from the same word that we get magician. Epiphany reveals that even in his infancy, Jesus Christ is for all humanity, not just for a chosen few. He is for the outsiders. He comes to draw people together. Wise men from the east, Syrians from the north, Egyptians from the south, Romans from the west. The truth that grasps us in the moment of Epiphany, the moment when Christ is revealed to the Gentiles, is that Jesus Christ is the very love of God incarnate. And that love cannot be confined to any ethnic or national identity. It cannot be restricted by gender or orientation or claimed only by the powerful and privileged. Jesus Christ, as the new King of Israel, is in fact Jesus Christ, the sovereign ruler over the whole world. King Herod was a politician. He did intentionally violent things to protect his power. That's why he shook with fear when the wise men told him that a star had risen in the sky to announce the birth of this new King Jesus. That tyrant knew that the birth of the true King Jesus meant the end of his own abusive and illegitimate reign of terror. Matthew tells us that he even ordered the massacre of all children younger than two around in and around Bethlehem so that he could rid himself of this newborn king. And of course, later in the story, they tried to stop Jesus by nailing him to a cross. But when Jesus Christ is at work in the world, the powers of cruelty and oppression cannot stop him. When Easter is alive, when Easter hope is alive, it is the tyrants and the power brokers and those who ignore human need for their own gain who should tremble. The gospel of Jesus is political. It addresses the concerns and affairs of the people and the city, the polis. It was first revealed to obscure shepherds in a field. From the beginning of his life, Jesus rattled the cage of Herod just by being born. And Herod, in fear and response to the news of this birth, lashed out at the children of Bethlehem. Later, when Jesus was older and his parents thought they'd lost him in the temple, Jesus' retort to them was, "Don't you know I'm about my Father's business?" And that business was and is, as Jesus says in Luke's gospel, to bring good news to the poor, proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, to seek and serve the lost, the marginalized, the hurting, the refugee, to seek justice, to speak truth to power, to act nonviolently, to stand against oppression, and to love everyone. He says that the truly blessed ones are the ones who are poor in spirit, the mournful, the meek, the merciful, the pure in heart, the ones who make peace. Whenever Christians think Jesus can be used and or manipulated to promote their own needs and their own ends, they are mistaken, whether they are in the White House or in the poorhouse. Whenever Christians think that Jesus blesses the wealthy and disparages the poor, they are mistaken. Whenever Christians proclaim that some politician or power broker who ignores the cries of the poor and turns a deaf ear to the pleas of the hungry and the orphan and the alien is somehow chosen by God, they are sorely mistaken. Whenever we ignore the least and the least ones and seek out the successful and the powerful, we are looking for the Messiah in the wrong town and at the wrong time. Some years ago, a reporter from the BBC interviewed one of America's prosperity preachers, a preacher who preached a false gospel of power and wealth and worldly success and who had a large following. The reporter asked, "You preach a message of success and prosperity, don't you?" The preacher replied, "Of course I do. I think Jesus helps us sail, not fail." But the reporter was sharp. And she knew some scriptures, so she asked, "But didn't Jesus die on a cross as one who was rejected and condemned as a criminal? How does that fit in with the gospel of success?" "Oh," said the preacher, "like all great men, Jesus had his setbacks, but on Easter he put it all behind him." "I don't think so. On Easter, Jesus did not put the cross behind him, as if it were some unfortunate misstep in an otherwise successful journey on his way to becoming a powerful Messiah. The resurrection on Easter validates the gift of love and redemption that Jesus gave in his death on Good Friday when he joined himself with all who suffer and who are oppressed." That prosperity preacher was looking for Jesus in Herod's palace, not in Bethlehem. Here we are, 2,000 years from Jesus. The gospel of Jesus, which we begin to understand from his birth in Bethlehem, calls us to act in the ways that he did. The story of Epiphany is to put into action in our own lives the light that was born in Bethlehem, the light that moves us to leave Bethlehem and seek out the hurting and the broken, the least of Jesus' brothers and sisters, and then serve them. Let us go forward from here.